So we are very honored to have with us our guest today, Issa Bloomi. He is Associate Professor of Asian, Middle Eastern, and Turkish Studies at Stockholm University. He's also the author of 7 books, several articles, and his latest book is the subject of our interview and show today. It's called Destroying Yemen, What Chaos in Arabia Tells Us About the World, and it's published by the University of California Press. It just came out this year. It's a very good book. I actually got it here and I got it marked up. Issa Bloomi is an historian of the modern Muslim world, and his work extends from comparative studies of late Ottoman administrative affairs in the Albania, Kosovo, and Arabia to contemporary affairs in the Balkans, Turkey, and Yemen. That's all, like, I mean, we could do a show on, we could do 20 shows, I think, on all these subjects. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us, Issa.
It's great to be with you guys. Hopefully we'll have a informative couple of minutes
good
together.
Yes, we hope so too.
Yeah, we hope so. So
Issa, I think, you know, the show has been going on now for 3 years, Radio Warner, our podcast. We just celebrated our 3rd year anniversary, and one of the main recurring wars or themes that we keep coming back to has been the Yemen war and the atrocious Western media press coverage of this, you know, really horrible war, and trying to understand the war as well. Your book is one of the very few books on the war, and certainly, I mean, there's as little as there is out there about the Yemen war, there's even less critical sort of analysis of the war and what's going on there. There's a lot, I mean, your book covers a large period, but really focuses on, you know, what's led up to the war and what's going on in the war and the different imperial interests that have created the current war in Yemen. I guess it's hard to pick a place to start, but I think where I would like to start, if that's all right with you, would be with the Arab Spring and the kind of forced resignation of Saleh and the and then, you know, the rise of Hadi's interim government, and then what he was going to do, Hadi was going to do in the interim period, 2012 to 14, I guess it would be, or 15. So could you start with the Arab Spring in Yemen and sort of what outside imperial forces were, you know, what their interests were and how they were involved or what they were doing?
Sure. Like with many parts of the region, long targeted for extractive exploitation, a new wave of kind of invasive finance capitalism had directly impacted the lives of people throughout Yemen from the late 1990s onwards. And basically everything came to its climax by late 2010 even. I authored a book called Chaos in Yemen, which came out in 2010 and basically highlighted what was going on at the time, which was increased violence throughout the country, the kind of manipulation of violence, use of American technology, even use of American willingness to kill civilians to basically take out political opponents of Ali Abdullah Saleh's regime. That culminated into a kind of widespread protest throughout the country in very different regions that had long been treated quite distinctively. The country had just gone through 4 wars in the Northwest, in areas that today are generally associated in Western media with the Houthis, so-called Houthis, but it's a much broader coalition of targets that Ali Abdullah Saleh's regime and global capitalism, what we'd call globalization in many different forms, basically pushed people to the extreme of they had just had, couldn't take it anymore, and so they took to the streets, more or less predating the events that took place elsewhere. But just like with the events in Tunisia or Egypt or elsewhere, very very much a local factors contributing to the initial phases or initial waves, if you will. But what immediately made the events on the streets, just like in Egypt or in Tunisia, international of importance were how Al Jazeera in particular, which is the kind of weapon of choice by very powerful interests in American politics through alliances that the Qatari Emirate had made over the years, investing heavily in influencing American British politics, buying up massive influence by property developments and investment in corporations and kind of
think tanks, right? And
think tanks. That's
Al Gore's current TV, right? Didn't Al Jazeera buy it?
Al Jazeera got into that as well. Yeah. And many early career of what we would call our more progressive kind of journalists today started by writing for Al Jazeera English, which is something that will be very important for us understanding why the war today is taking a certain form and how it's presented in Western media. But so, I mean, there were a lot of things that were culminating by 2011 in the outside world. There was, of course, the financial crisis of 2007-2008, which dramatically changed the political economy of finance. And so you had basically a scramble for liquidity throughout the world. And Yemen was, surprisingly, being a very poor country, at least on the books, was also a country that was one of those untapped kind of resources that had huge potential for development. Ali Abdullah Saleh's regime had already started to allow for this kind of invasive capitalism, investment in property developments. The Qataris in particular, and Saudis to a lesser extent, got heavily involved in developing properties, speculative kind of real estate development.
Which parts of Yemen?
They were targeting coastal areas. Mm-hmm. They were hoping to kind of build up tourist destinations, especially the more kind of seedy side, sex tourism in particular. So, you know, you had this kind of seasonal tourism that was going to Beirut or to Egypt, and they were hoping to exploit the fact that the availability of cheap labor in this horrible industry coming from the Horn of Africa in particular could be exploited. It's a very short trip from the Gulf or from many parts of Saudi Arabia to Yemen.
Right.
And it's cheaper, kind of. So, you know, you had the higher end stuff that people would go to Europe for, or they would actually buy the services there in their own country. But Yemen was a kind of a tempting kind of untapped place to develop this kind of darker side of global capitalism. And in the meantime, there was also the infrastructure that constantly needed attention. So it's a country that had still considerable potential to borrow money. Ali Abdullah Saleh was just getting into the global markets for leveraging the future of Yemen for current and future development projects. And so it was just getting into the fold of becoming a major player, if you say, if you will, in a regional way. And what's so interesting about all this, with Islamic banking just becoming an important component to the global economy, this was another. Yemen was kind of a laboratory for the initial phases of microfinancing in the Islamic frame, if you will. And this is something that I mentioned in the book, in chapters 5 and 6, I believe. And so, the Middle East had not been integrated in ways that other parts of the world had been over the previous 15, 20 years. And Yemen, in many ways, was serving as a kind of an entry point. So Dubai Ports World, for instance, which had quite legally signed lease agreements with Ali Abdullah Saleh's regime in the previous 10 years to develop port cities from Mukalla to Aden to Hodeidah, was already indicating that it had kind of an expansionist role, ambitions to not only invest in North America and big assets throughout the world, but also in a more strategically placed areas like the Horn of Africa and Yemen included. And this was all important because the UAE's rivals, especially Qatar, which is a major supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood throughout the world, and is seen by Abu Dhabi and all the emirs of the UAE as a threat to their stability. They're the only regime in the Gulf that is very hostile to political Islam, especially as it evolved as a kind of tool for regime change throughout the Middle East. And they also began to realize that Qatar, through its investment of the Clinton into the Clintons and then the Barack Obama administration and their infiltration into various media at all scales of academia, that there was something coming to a head with their heavy investment in the Islah Party inside Yemen itself. Mm-hmm. It seemed to be coming all at one moment of time and kind of a perfect storm. And it just so happened, it was just waiting for that kind of moment where the violence on the streets demanded foreign intervention. And the Barack Obama administration was very, very sympathetic to the positioning of especially Qatari interest in overthrowing the regime of Ali Abdullah Saleh, who proved no longer capable of sustaining stability or at least allowing for the continued exploitation of Yemen, the steering of Yemen towards complete subordination to the global capitalist interest, if you will. And so what was a very popular and kind of rapidly transforming sets of events in different cities on the ground was co-opted, steered into the direction which then basically was kidnapped, if you will, by the Qatari groups, Qatari-backed personalities like Ali Muhsin, who is this notorious kind of general who has been in bed with the most radical elements of political Islam throughout Arabia for the last 15 years.
You mean like with Al-Qaeda and the Arab Peninsula? Or
yes, I mean, these categories that we use in the West is not the most accurate ways for us to figure out who are the big players on the ground in Yemen, because, I mean, the loyalties are gravitating around individuals who can bring with them, say, 1,000 men or 500 armed men.
Right.
And they usually end up getting glossed over by these big umbrella kind of simplistic references to Al-Qaeda and to Daesh and things like that. And these alliances that make up the larger umbrella group of Daesh or ISIS, as I guess we say it in the West, or Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula, those things are always changing. And so the personalities like Ali Muhsin, who had been, out of convenience, a general for Ali Abdullah Saleh's regime until 2011, and he was one of the principals involved in trying to suppress the rebellions of the Northwest, which is it's a complicated story, and there are a lot of things that need to be, I think, foregrounded before we can get into that. But simplistically, the West has used the reference to the Houthis and their supposed Shia affiliations as a simple proxy of Iranian attempts at influencing events in the region, which I make a very clear and emphatic statement that is not true. This was used by Ali Abdullah Saleh, its occasional allies in Saudi Arabia in particular, to justify the use of extreme violence on this particular region, which continues to be basically in a state of war from beginning of 2000 until today.
Mm-hmm.
And what Qataris have basically fundamentally done is undermined this Ali Abdullah Saleh's regime, who has strong relations between UAE and Saudi Arabia, and basically positioned themselves to take over and harness the so-called revolution of 2011 and basically kidnap it. And what has happened subsequently is that Saudi Arabia, UAE, and all the other players in the region have had to adapt to this fact that Barack Obama's administration was basically an extension of the interest of Qatar. And we can get into the details of who represents that kind of dynamic partnership, if you will, in American politics. But it was basically a series of reactions to that moment of, much like in Egypt, and much like in Tunisia, where also Qatari-backed Muslim Brotherhood elements became the dominant, let's say, the victors, or the ones who stood out in this kind of rapidly changing events on the ground.
So, yes, John Dolan here. If I'm understanding what you're saying, before the current civil war was in progress, the distinction between Qatari interests and Saudi interests, and for that matter, UAE interests, was already clear. And the U.S. administration was much closer to Qatari interests than to Saudi as they diverged. Is that right?
That's correct. It's especially pronounced between the UAE and these other two powered interests. But I mean, obviously, when Trump comes to power and he, with his new kind of new crew, if you will, in the State Department and elsewhere, they clearly had different ideas. And the first thing they wanted to do was isolate Qatar, which had very strong connections with especially the Clintons and by default the Obama administration. So if you start looking at it through this prism, the Yemen wars or the events in Yemen, which I would also challenge us to think differently, as it's not a civil war in the sense that it's a series of conflicts locally that then get co-opted by the outside, but it's the opposite. It's outside factors that contribute to the violence in Yemen itself. Mm-hmm. And violence is an apparatus for gaining influence in Yemen. And it's not clear that those who are shooting at each other right now are the same ones who shot at each other 3 years ago or in next week, right? So people are in desperate situations. People are very hungry. It's always been exploited, this factor, and people are willing to take up arms. But what's really frustrating the so-called coalition for the last 3 years, and why this is never going to be a war that could be actually won militarily, is that people, the mercenaries that have been hired and been being paid, or whatever they're being paid, are doing so out of desperation. And they're doing so also with not much dedication to the Emiratis or to the Saudis. Basically, whenever they get armed, they go and immediately sell their weapons to the black market, knowing full well that the weapons will be replaced and then the cycle continues.
Mm. That's a really good observation. Yeah. I think we'd like to slow it down to talk about the problem with mercenaries, because perversely enough, mercenaries are now a hot new topic in the U.S., and there are people making a career out of saying mercenaries are the way to go. Yeah. But the issues you raise bring up some of the obvious problems with mercenaries, such as if this war is your profession, you don't want the war to end in a hurry. And if you have backers with the deepest pockets in the world, which these mercenaries do, then if you go and sell your weapons, they can easily supply you with new ones. So what you're buying is a force which has a vested interest in stalemate and corruption. And that explains a lot. For example, 3 months ago, I mean, I was tracking this pretty carefully. 3 months ago, Hudaydah was about to fall. It hasn't fallen. It's not the kind of mountain terrain that the Houthi or the Shia or however we want to describe them, it's not the kind of terrain that's supposed to be in their favor. A huge armored force with a lot of air power should presumably have had no trouble taking the coastal town. But 3 months later, they're still on the edge of Hudaydah. And I think part of that, I mean, you tell me, but part of that might be the fact that mercenaries have no terrible interests in
urban street fighting.
There are a couple of things there. Firstly, the mercenaries who are the kind of the cannon fodder, if you will, on the so-called coalition side are unfortunately mostly coming from Sudan or from Chad or from Cameroon. They're not the kind of the professional mercenaries one sees in Hollywood movies. Mm-hmm. Those guys are not yet in the theater on the ground in this most horrible parts of the war. There are some of them who are in this divided city of Taiz, which are in the mountains. That's a very nasty kind of war that really requires a professional kind of mercenary, special forces types who just kind of retire from the U.S. military or Australian military and end up working for Eric Prince, based in Abu Dhabi these days. But so the failure of the so-called coalition on the coastal areas is, one, they're fighting boys and young men who have lost everything. you know, this has been a war that's been going on for a long time in that part of Yemen, and they don't have family, and they know who did this. They know who's ruined them. And one of the reasons why we want to retrack a little bit how we refer to those who are opposing the Saudis and the Americans who are basically pushing this war forward is that it's not just a coalition of a small bunch of fanatics around a charismatic man of the 1990s, the Houthis, right? This is actually, they call themselves Ansarullah, which is already indicating a broader coalition. And if you look at their language, especially how they present themselves, they call themselves the Popular People's Army. So this is kind of very much resonant of the 60s and 70s of the Cold War. And it really is a broad coalition of people from all these different regions who have nowhere else to go. They've been bombarded daily. They've lost all their infrastructure. They've lost family members. They've seen the cynical use of air power, double tap and even triple tap techniques. They're not going to handle, they're not going to give up, and they know they have nowhere else to go. So that's the kind of opponent that these mercenaries are facing. And if you're some Sudanese guy who has not been paid yet, you know, and you're hearing rumors that people don't get paid, you know, working for the Saudis. And by the way, the Saudis do not have deep pockets. They are very much, I mean, that's one of the reasons why this war was necessary in the first place for Mohammed bin Salman, is that Saudi Arabia is in serious financial trouble, and they need to build a kind of asset base in order to, for things like privatize Aramco. Aramco is not worth.
I was going to say Aramco just to cancel its IPO.
Yeah, it's something that I wrote in the book, is that they're just not going to be able to sustain this unless they can capture the huge oil and gas resources of Yemen, which have largely not been untapped until now. And that was basically the whole thing, is that they were told in no uncertain terms that their line of credit has been dried up. They have to figure out new ways. Because again, it's the larger context of the global economy. There is this race now for liquidity. The Americans, especially under Joe Biden, who was the kind of vice president and representative of the banking industry in the United States, they've been desperately trying to secure these kinds of last remaining pools of liquidity in the global economy. If you notice, it was during an Obama administration, of course, paying off all the banks who had lost huge amounts of money in the 2007-2008 crisis. So where are they going to get the liquidity? They started closing down accounts in Switzerland, right? They started going after overseas accounts of Americans and more importantly, pushing third world kind of corners of development. Dubai, Abu Dhabi, these areas that were kind of sucking up all this kind of savings of the third world and pushing them into towards investing in T-bills or trying to redirect their money to offshore banking associated with Delaware or things like that, right? Mm-hmm. So these are the kinds of, the biggest offshore banking industry in the world are the Channel Islands and Delaware. I mean, people don't realize that, you know, and this is their competition were the Swiss banks, right? Mm-hmm. And the competition are these cities like Dubai, which has been sucking up investment, where people are looking for returns on their investment, especially in the third world, Afghani money or money from East Africa. Mm. They're trying to find a safe place to put their money, and they don't want to put it in an American bank account. They certainly don't want to put it in a Swiss bank account, because they saw what happened. Mm. And so they were trying to, you know, find returns, and property speculation was going very well. Dubai, you were making pretty good money if you put your money in a condominium project. And the similar thing was beginning to happen in Sana'a, in Yemen, or in Aden. And so this is
so
what
they were speculating on property development with that money that was being sucked up in Dubai and stuff, was then going into driving up property development and so on, right, in Yemen. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah, uh-huh. I mean, if everyone reads the Financial Times or the New York Times, how they were propping up this Mohammed bin Salman and trying to sell him as this reformer for Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. one of the big projects, 2030, right, was the whole idea to develop the Red Sea, the whole Red Sea coast of Saudi Arabia, yeah. like up like Dubai. Dubai was the model.
They bought those islands from Egypt, right? I was astonished, because I spent a year in Saudi Arabia, in Najran, in fact, and I could not believe they would want tourists. But it made sense in a Saudi kind of way. Like, you get the tourists, but you quarantine them from the mainland. You put them on this island, and on the islands, there's a whole different set of rules. And besides, it's near Jeddah, which they already consider decadent. So it kind of made sense.
Absolutely. And again, there's a big issue that why are we allowing all this money, all this kind of savings, all this kind of excess capital to flow to Marbella or to, you know, to go and develop Dubai? Because lots of Saudi money, especially in the middle class, they're all looking for returns, right? And so they go to Dubai and they buy properties. Or they go somewhere else. And because of all the countries in the region were doing exactly this, following the Dubai model, there was becoming less and less available capital. And Saudi Arabia in particular is not a place where you would want to invest your money, right? And so, clearly with this race to secure some kind of liquidity to keep paying the bills for this war in Yemen, you know, it's upwards of $300 million a day. And, you know, it's okay to screw the Bin Laden Group, which has now gone bankrupt and taken over by the Saudi government. You know, if you go to Mecca, Medina today, you'll see all these Bin Laden Group projects, which have been shut down. There are half-built constructions all over Mecca, Medina.
And the anti-corruption drive that was so widely publicized, in this context, it becomes more of a shakedown.
Absolutely.
Get what's left from the oligarchs lined up.
Exactly. They have all these bank accounts. Well, okay, we'll set you up in the Ritz-Carlton. We'll torture you. Many of them have actually died in the bathtubs of the Ritz-Carlton, right, as they tortured them. And, you know, give us your bank accounts. And that's what basically happened, right?
You know, so you don't hear about that in the Thomas Friedman or David Ignatius.
You hear little jokes about how it was a 4-star place, not a 5-star. Yuck.
Yeah, man, this is just, and again, it's so unconscionable because these guys who joke, of course, and then the result is that in Yemen, you have millions of people starving, you know, at the, mm-hmm. on the throes of starvation, and it's part of this larger game, and it starts much earlier than, you know, the actual bombardment in March 2015.
Right.
And Yemenis are the most sophisticated, the bravest, the most dynamic peoples of the entire Arabian Peninsula. And that's been the case for, you know, a millennia. And that's, you know, that's one of the things that had always been a concern. I mean, Saudi Arabia occupies large parts of Yemen, northwest Yemen, the Asir region. I mean, if you were in Najran, you know very well the politics.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's one of the reasons that I knew early on that this Iran stuff was just manufactured BS, because people in Najran, I mean, they're cautious because this is a competent regime, at least at internal security, and there was an actual rebellion in Najran about a decade ago that was completely hushed up and that nobody heard about, but everyone there will say, you know, they knocked on the door and that was the last time I saw my cousin. They never talk about Iran. Iran just didn't figure in the story. What they do say, and when I checked this out, I was kind of surprised to find it's not just urban legend. It's true. Saudi Arabia officially rented Najran province at gunpoint in the 1930s and was officially supposed to give it back. But by the time they were supposed to give it back to Yemen, they were in tight with the U.S. and U.K., and the disparity in power between Saudi Arabia and Yemen was so great that they just said no.
That's right. It's both, especially highlighted in my first book, Chaos in Yemen, because I was trying to account for what was happening in the 2000s in that area, the borders between Yemen and Saudi Arabia, but even a little bit mentioned in this book. And it's basically in year 2000, because there was this ongoing agreements every 30 years, they would renegotiate this lease. It was basically a lease agreement, mm-hmm. right? And the peoples who lived on both sides of the border were allowed to travel back and forth. And in year 2000, the Americans, with their, ironically enough, advising countries to start sealing their borders, you know, while Europe was kind of breaking down barriers, the Americans and the British were making huge amounts of money militarizing the borders of other countries. Mm. And you see the same thing in the UAE. They've built a huge militarized fence between UAE and Oman, which is kind of, I mean, it's devastating for the local communities because, again, it makes travel back and forth to see families, to take your animals to graze wherever there's water, to basically upset entirely local economies. And that's how people reacted to that in this area between Saudi Arabia and Yemen. And they formally came to an agreement in 2000. They delineated the border finally, which included this very contested empty areas where all the oil and gas of Hadramaut is. And until basically they both came to this kind of secret agreement that once we start to develop these resources, whenever there is the time and the need for it, that they would be a share, they would share some of these resources. The problem is for the Saudis is that their time has come up. They just basically need money. And they, one of the ideas, one of the austerity programs that the IMF imposes on many countries, including Yemen, that's one of the reasons why they had an explosion in 2011, and again in 2014, when ultimately the people rose up once again and overthrew this Hadi interim government. Saudi Arabia basically had to start privatizing all their assets, including, you know, trying to find that liquidity they need through the partial privatization, issuing of a partial IPO for a percentage of Aramco. And the problem for Aramco, as anyone in industry who knows what they're talking about, and you, that means you have to go to Zurich and find these brokers. You're the ones who are, you know, basically arranging for the tankers to pick up oil and then sell it somewhere else.
Right.
They tell you that the eastern wells of Saudi Arabia are drying up, and they don't have the oil anymore. And to keep up with their daily production, they're basically buying oil offshore, and then, you know, reflagging it as Saudi oil in order to just maintain this kind of market impression that they are they're market makers. Where in fact, everybody in the industry knows that they're just, I mean, they still have some line of credit, but it's drying up. And it really started to dry up with the Trump administration. Trump is, and the people around him are far more clever than we give them credit for in this regard. And it's basically the conflict between the three big players in the GCC was exposed. And as we saw, Qatar was basically pushed aside, and Saudi Arabia tried to make a dash to occupy it like it did Bahrain in 2011.
Yeah.
And basically Turkey and Iran and other players basically said, you know, that's not going to happen. Right?
I read that Tillerson also told them no. And that was one of the reasons why he was tossed out. What do you think of that? Is that right? Or
I find that whole AP story a little suspicious. And that goes in with the whole Qatari influence in the media. If you look at the three journalists who reported that, they have all Al Jazeera connections. And you'll know, if you actually read closely, you'll see that Qatar is not mentioned once in its involvement in Yemen, for instance. So Yemen has been completely exonerated. And, you know, and it's also basically a hit piece on UAE, especially UAE.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll note that a lot of stories have been popping up about UAE's investment in torture, prisons, and things like that. But again, suspiciously, the ones who are really the ones who started this horrible, you know, chain reaction that led to now 3.5 years of war on Yemen has been basically excised from the story altogether.
Yeah, I want to get into this a little later, but now that you brought it up, let's talk about it, because I think this is one of the many great insights you have, which is that Qatar was one of the instigators of this horrible war, you know, the worst humanitarian crisis in the world today, the worst cholera crisis and famine, you know, verge of famine crisis. And Qatar has somehow managed to be completely taken out of any of the reporting. Somehow it's not involved anymore. Now, granted, the Saudis and the UAE in their own squabbles, which we really aren't well understood outside of the region, have obviously they turned on Qatar. And somehow Qatar has been able to come off as looking like some sort of progressive peacenik good guy in all of this, which is insane, of course. So I guess, and one of you know, again, one of your other great insights is how they've been doing this for a long time in terms of building up connections and credibility through Al Jazeera, which has done a lot of great reporting. It's also done, I mean, we've talked about this on Radio Warner, that's done some really horrible stuff, like in the Syria war, they would had on a popular host of some show that was calling for, you know, the extermination of Shia and that sort of stuff. But this doesn't come out, then they have another face, which is sort of the English language face, which is right. Can you talk a bit about this? Because I think this is really fascinating. And so it's not that the stories that have been broken by and you've traced some of these reporters to, you know, old ties with Al Jazeera and Qatar. It's not that these stories are false. It's that these stories are coming out because, I mean, it just reminds me a bit of when I reported in Russia, and you had different media outlets by different competing oligarch groups, and they would plant true stories, kompromat, you know, which is now has become a big word because of Trump. But this is going back in the 90s, you know, they'd plant these kompromat stories in their media outlets. And it wasn't that they weren't true. They were true or mostly true. But then you also needed to know why they were those stories appeared there. So can you talk a bit about how Qatar influences all of this?
Sure. Of course, this all ties in with the rise of natural gas as a means of fueling the global economy. And it was a new kind of fuel, right? It was it was before it was just allowed to escape without any concern. And so at some point in the 90s, natural gas becomes a big important component. But that's one aspect of it.
Because Qatar is a major, major natural gas producer, right?
14 to 15% of the world's supply. It shares the biggest field with Iran. Not that they're allies at all. They're actually very much hostile to each other. But, you know, business is business. And you don't want to start a war with a country, a small little emirate that has an American base on it. Mm. So you agree to divide up spoils of this one field. And that's exactly what the Saudis, they misunderstood what was, you know, the dynamics of the time. They thought they were going to solve all their finance problems by just basically taking over a little island of 300,000 citizens. But again, Turkey immediately sent their forces and stopped that. So who is Qatar? Mm-hmm. I would highly recommend that everyone read the first chapter of Joseph Massad's Islam and Liberalism. Or is it Liberalism and Islam? I can't remember. But it's a University of Chicago Press book, 2015. And it's a story that is, for all the same reasons why we don't talk about Yemen and why we don't talk about Qatar anymore like this, why academia is silent about so many things about political Islam. Political Islam became an instrument in the late 19th and early 20th century for empire. You can't account for why the Saudis and Wahhabism spread so quickly in the 1920s to the point of occupying Mecca, Medina, and reaching the more or less present frontiers it has today, without its deep alliance with the British. Mm-hmm. The British provided the weapons, provided the money. I mean, there was no oil at the time, and the British invested in a form of political Islam that would be compliant and work. They would be able to work with Saud family because
That's one thing that we have tracked in this program with great difficulty and with great persistence. In spite of the difficulty, it's very hard to see that pattern. It's if you want to go researching, say, Soviet atrocities or something, you'll find that it's like canoeing down a fast river. It's very easy.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you try to track the alliance between the British Empire and political Islam, there are a few sources. There's one that we read.
Mark Curtis.
Do you remember the
guy's
name?
Mark Curtis.
Yeah, but there are very few sources. Like, and we find it again and again. We've been tracking it in Nigeria. Like, what happened in Nigeria? Basically, the British decided to go with the Caliphate, to go with the Hausa, because it's much easier to do colonial business with a society like that, which is utterly hierarchical, as compared to the Yoruba or the Igbo, who have a much more localized and querulous polity. So yeah, this is a pattern that we find throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. And I can give you some citations you can put onto the website at some point. We can agree to that we share with the audience.
It'd be great. The book here, Islam and Liberalism, I just looked it up after you were suggested by Joseph Massad, Massad.
Okay. Chapter one of that book, look at the footnotes. Okay. It really does develop this. I mentioned it in my own work.
Yes.
I coined the phrase, they're using Islam against Muslims, because at the turn of the century, all the colonial powers, the Dutch, the French, they ruled over the entire Islamic world. And they were facing right. all these kind of rebellions throughout, the, whether it be in Sumatra, whether it be in East Africa, whether it be throughout the West Africa. So they were all
Sudan.
Trying to... Sudan, absolutely. They were all trying to harness, you know, in some way, try to sedate and subdue this very big problem. And another interesting book by Isra Hussein, she wrote a comparative study about how the British basically created Sharia law. They were the ones who she had compared Malaysia in India and Egypt and how the British were basically trying to codify the implementation of a uniformly enforced so-called Islamic law, which was never done in the history of Islam. Right? I mean, the judges were given enormous freedom to determine and understand and interpret and then adjudicate according to what the community needed. And this certainly did not service the interest of global colonial powers, which needed some kind of uniformity, needed some kind of medium to subdue their otherwise rebellious pockets throughout the world. And so you have this combination of scholarship beginning to make that kind of connection. But it does not resonate, especially in this Middle East studies programs today, which they love this whole story of there's a monolith called Islam. Muslims operate under kind of a hierarchy in which the imam or the chief mufti dictates and everyone else follows along without any kind of... It's completely ahistorical. It's very much a modern form of Islam, what we would call the revivalists or the Salafists, is a 20th century phenomenon. And why Qatar is so important and interesting is that it was basically a backwater. And even the Thani family throughout the 19th, early 20th century was nothing. They were part of the Trucial States regime. They were basically subordinates to the British throughout the 20th century and had no contribution whatsoever to this rising Salafism in the 20th century, which was primarily based out of the Muslim Brotherhood movements, which came out of the British-occupied Egypt, by the way, mm-hmm. not by mistake. When Rashid Rida is disseminating through the Manar newspaper, he's able to freely distribute this very compliant kind of notion of how Islam embraces capitalism. There's no direct fundamental conflict with, you know, making money even through a certain use of finance, and being cooperative with colonial intermediaries.
And I mean, well, one figure that I admit I'm just belatedly discovering in this struggle is Nasser himself, and I should have known more about this before, because Nasser was involved in an implacable struggle with the Brotherhood.
Oh, yeah.
And it's because he resented above all this, none of the emblematic issues. I mean, he laughed at everybody having to wear the hijab and all that. Yeah. But what he really got mad about is, you're blocking my land reform program. Mm-hmm. You want the Falahin to be Falahin until the end of time.
Absolutely.
And the hell with that. And that's why, you know, Nasser was not normally a very bloody man in his own way. He became very bloody in that struggle. But then, in response, as I'm just starting to realize, what was left of Britain, feeling especially vengeful after Suez, said, well, we got these Saudis. I think they could use some brothers.
Yeah. And what's so interesting about it is exactly in 1961, when the Saudi Arabia, who had already been, since the end of World War II, become basically, as Robert Vitalis wrote, America's Kingdom, right? Mm-hmm. Highly recommended book about labor relations and race and how the Americans imported race politics to Saudi Arabia. Very interesting story about the rise of Aramco. But America's Kingdom had, of course, very much still strong insinuated relations with the British in certain ways, right? While the British were no longer global powers, they were certainly had lots of cultural influence on the ruling elites of their former kind of puppet states, including South Yemen, right? All these emirates that formed, nine emirates that formed separate polities in what became, in 1967, the Marxist state of South Yemen, were ruled by these nine families, very much akin to what we had in Abu Dhabi and Ras Al Khaimah and Qatar and Kuwait, etc. So in 1961, Saudi Arabia opens a university to train the the world's imams, you know, no longer to go to Al-Azhar, because Al-Azhar had become now embedded with the Egyptian radical kind of transformative anti-British.
Yeah, Nasser was using Al-Azhar against the Brotherhood.
So then suddenly the Saudis become the kind of, you know, the new place where we're going to train the future generation of imams who are going to go around the world and proselytizing that in a way that you're going to be compliant to Riyadh, that we're going to be issuing decrees now from Riyadh, fatwas, which then the world's Muslims are supposedly to basically embrace as the kind of guidelines to adjudicating Islamic law or ruling over our communities or managing our communities. And they open up a university in Medina, and they don't have capacity, they don't have scholars, so they start importing scholars who are mostly Brotherhood, and which becomes a very fascinating thing over time, which ultimately undermines Wahhabi influence in Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a clash, it becomes quite violent, the Saudi state is harnessed to subjugate and in many ways uproot this established, kind of, let's say, all the professors were again attached to the Brotherhood. And it's more or less around this time where you see 79, the Mecca is occupied, right? There's this kind of rebellion within the conservative elements of Sunni Islam. And there's this bunch of thinkers coming out of Damascus and Jordan. And increasingly, they're finding safe haven in places like Qatar. And it's at some point when it becomes clear to these, as I'm suggesting, as other like Mark Curtis and others are suggesting, that this Salafist kind of revivalist orthodoxy, this Islam that never really functioned in the history of Islam, in the Islamic world, people are beginning to hold their nose to Saudi Arabia. They're too corrupt. They're so blatantly they're antithetical. Is that the word you use?
Yes, antithetical to what they preach, right?
Yeah. To what they preach. There's so much hypocrisy that Muslims are looking for something real. So mm-hmm. there's rebellion within Saudi Arabia. And then here comes Qatar, conveniently, a much purer, without any kind of historical baggage and garbage to take with them. And they will become the kind of disseminators of a new generation of a Salafist. And that's where you begin to see the big split between in the Gulf itself. Qatar becomes basically for the younger generations, those who are slowly being indoctrinated in European mosques, for instance. In 1970, Saudi Arabia signs exclusive agreements with all the governments of France and Belgium and throughout Western Europe that they would be the ones building the mosques. They would be ones sending the imams to these mosques. And therefore, all the traditional small-scale mosques that, you know, most of the workers from North Africa or from Turkey or from the Balkans who went as guest workers to Europe from the 50s onwards, they didn't have any mosques. They had no infrastructure. And they were practicing what the Salafists called traditional Islam, which is Sufism and reverence to the Ahl Bayt, the family of the Prophet, right? Mm-hmm. Which is exactly what the Wahhabis and the Saudis despise, because one, they have no link to Islamic heritage. They're just a bunch of Bedou from some oasis in Eastern Arabia. They have no links to the longer history of Islam. And they've been systematically destroying all references, often through this so-called campaign against Shia, this all references to traditional Islam, whether they are in Syria. The first thing they do whenever their hacks enter into a town in Syria is blow up the mosques and blow up the libraries. Some of the first things they were destroying when they were bombing Yemen were the manuscript collections in all these cities. I mean, these are 1,500 years of manuscripts stored in these mosques and libraries and all incinerated. They're basically rewriting and basically clean, you know, with a clean slate. This is what they've been trying to do throughout the 20th century. We're moving back to the 7th century. We're going to completely cut out the 1,500 years of heritage and of history. We're starting anew with a very modern, austere form of Orthodox Islam. And so Qatar replaces Saudi Arabia, especially for a younger generation of kids who have grown up now in Europe or in North America under these imams trained in this Medina school, who are all trained by Muslim Brotherhood types already. And so this is where we begin to see the importance of the links between liquefied natural gas as a kind of way to actually fuel the future development throughout the world, new source of speculative finance, as well as the social engineering tool of political Islam of the 20th century. And Qatar becomes an important component of that. And the way that especially Al Jazeera English starts to, in a very subtle and sometimes quite dramatic way, gain the confidence, if you will, of an audience who has been denied now since the end of the Cold War, you know, legitimate voices of alternative, right, to empire. And so the Al Jazeera English was providing a very interesting set of voices, if you will, who were for once in English, you know, speaking truth to power, right? Whether it be against Zionism, whether it be against, you know, other kinds of overt forms of capitalist imperialism. And so within a generation, our generation, we've all become now, we all associated Al Jazeera English with, you know, our alternative media. And in the meantime, Arabic Al Jazeera is the most orthodox, most, let's say, puritanical, nasty, vicious, racist, sectarian. Yeah. I mean, it's completely opposite of what you would see in Al Jazeera English. And so you have a whole generation of who now have access to satellite TV throughout the Middle East and even in diasporas and in Europe, the United States, listening to this stuff. And I'm dealing with students now in Europe who have grown up on Al Jazeera Arabic. And the stuff that they're regurgitating, they're brainwashed. It's amazing.
We never hear this, John. Do you ever hear this?
We never hear this. No, you occasionally get a complaint about this because there are a few Arabic-speaking journalists, usually from the region, often from a minority sect, and therefore very scared, who try to tell people this, but it just doesn't get through. It's too fine a point.
I mean, just think about the big Arabic language newspapers that are published in the West. They're all owned by Qatar or Saudi Arabia, right? Mm-hmm. Even the big satellite channels, NBC or whatever it is that you have, they're either owned by these two states. And they all have very good commercial relations. They all have their licenses that are issued by the various countries in the West. And so it's basically, as you've noted, that you don't hear about it. And if you're a journalist and you want a job in the Arab world, you're going to have to apply for a job through these now. They have a monopoly. They have control of 85 or 90% of all content produced in the Middle East in Arabic.
One question I'd like to ask you is that in Saudi, the English language medium is Arab News, and it's kind of a joke. It's a really old-style regime newspaper that doesn't pretend to be anything else. Why didn't the Saudis, although maybe their cash flow problems explain this, why didn't they try to compete with Al Jazeera?
Well, they did a little bit later in the Arabic, right, and Al Arabiya. And they do have, they do take the position, but again, they don't have credibility, especially amongst the socially conservative. I mean, Erdogan's rise in Turkey is another example of this. I mean, he's very closely connected with the Brotherhood, and just think about how the rise of political Islam in Turkey corresponds with the rise of Qatar as becoming the alternative. It's largely because Saudi Arabia no longer had credibility,
that resonates really strongly.
This is such a great point. Yeah, go ahead, John.
Yeah, what I remember most strongly about my Muslim colleagues in Najran was just coming to work in a fury and saying out of nowhere, "This is not Islam." Yeah.
And think about who was rising up and really representing the gut feeling of hatred towards Zionism and towards Western capitalism and imperialism in general. Hezbollah, 1982, they rose up, and it was not about Shia. They represented the entirety of the poor in the Middle East. In 2006, they were the movement. Mm-hmm. I mean, 2006 was basically a make or break moment for the West. They said, we have to destroy this movement because they just defeated Israel. They just forced Israel, you know, to, with their tails between their legs, to go back across the border. And believe me, if anyone who will be willing to be honest about it, even those who are now who hate the Hezbollah, yeah, as the party of the devil.
Especially after they intervened in Syria, then they were able to spin it as a sectarian thing. But yeah. Yes, I think what a lot of people don't realize in the West is just the hurt and the humiliation of a series of defeats on Arabs in particular and Muslims in general. And then Hezbollah comes along and they kick ass in 2006.
I mean, even in 79 with Iran, I mean, again, people speak, oh, wow, you know, you can actually reverse regimes here. And, you know, they actually resonate. And there was a kind of cross so-called sectarian lines. There was this big embrace. And of course, the war, Iran-Iraq war, tried to reverse that, right? Well, it was one of the first things that the Gulf states did in investing in Saddam Hussein was to try to very quickly reverse that, take the oil wealth away from the Islamic Republic of Iran, because that's mostly in the Arab-speaking populated areas where the oil is found, at least the petroleum in Iran. And you know, it was still, this whole sectarian language was still a little bit too dangerous to tap into in those days. It was, you know, still the kind of Persia versus Arabs kind of stuff.
Right.
And indeed, many Shia of southern Iraq joined to fight Iran, right? Mm-hmm. Because they were not quite sure where loyalties needed to lay at that stage. And it's only, you begin to see the investment in this sectarianism really with the decision to turn on Hezbollah and take away Hezbollah's popular resistance cachet, if you will. Mm-hmm. The PLO was gone. Mm-hmm. The Palestinians were kind of destroyed. And yet here comes Hezbollah, not only for Lebanese purposes, you know, throwing the Zionists out of Lebanon, but also, you know, carrying the banner for Palestine, carrying the banner for the poor, and you know, and this is something that we can export. And it's not, again, it was not an Iranian project. It was this was blood, sweat, and tears of indigenous Lebanese fighters, right? The poorest of the poor in Lebanon, who have been screwed for the last 40 years, the so-called Shia, which the French created this system of, you know, dividing up the communities along sectarian lines, very much a product again of French colonial strategies, and the British to a lesser extent, and that was like the key turning point. And but of course Al Jazeera was already functioning then, right? Al Jazeera was already making its waves, especially in the English-speaking world, and eventually it gained an audience for a very different reason amongst these most hostile Muslim Brotherhood-oriented types. And this is more or less corresponds with the rise of what becomes AKP in it's the Gulenist, it's another form of political Islam in Turkey that undermines the nationalist secularist of traditional politics in Turkey. And what it did, it also undermined the potential for violence in Turkey, right? Because hardworking Turks, who large numbers of them had family members in Germany and elsewhere, they were decent, hardworking people who were being treated like crap by, you know, the industrial elite of Turkey. And the only way to avoid what was coming down, what you could see in the horizon, was to somehow harness their sensibilities, if you will.
Yeah, and that's an interesting parallel that we've talked about before. That you can feel with Erdogan that he's harnessing a long felt inland resentment, and in that way it seems like one of the few states where you can, with a lot of footnotes and qualifiers, make a kind of rough parallel to the United States. There's a resentment there that the elite never understood, and it's now coming out, and they still don't understand it.
Right. I mean, I don't know how coherent we could ever have in terms of a unified resistance in the United States. There's nothing that actually conjoins the disparate group. I mean, it's becoming even more fragmented, it seems, the kind of cultural politics, identity politics that's being spewed out in various media. So in Turkey they didn't have that mechanism. So it's again a make or break. You can either go the direction of Iran and have a real revolution, or you can kind of have someone who with the Brotherhood embraces capitalism and encourages property ownership and, you know, be compliant and, you know, we'll represent your interests. We'll build mosques. We'll make everyone, you know, feel like there's progress because we'll build bridges and tunnels and you'll be able to have enough money to go on vacation for the first time in your lives, right? I mean, these are very important things for people who don't have that.
Sure.
And that's all crashing now, of course, because one, it was very much based on borrowing money left and right. And the Erdogan people around him, especially, are very corrupt. The family itself is very corrupt. We've got invested in trying to destroy Syria, right? Which was a very nasty kind of turn of events for the region. And now who knows where that this is all going? I mean, are they playing the Russians? Are they playing the Iranians? Mm-hmm. I mean, the economy is in a free fall right now in Turkey. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they've in basically Qatar and Turkey are tied to the hip at this stage in regional political terms. And it's not that quite clear what role Iran plays in all that. Mm-hmm. But going back to Yemen, Iran has no role to play in Yemen. It culturally and historically had no links. It's rather pathetically now, you know, putting on their various news channels on occasion horrible, you know, the news, right? They're showing that children are getting bombed daily. But, you know, there is it's basically impossible to infiltrate and provide any kind of support anyways. But they wouldn't risk getting in a bigger spat by giving Stinger missiles to these guys.
No, I mean, if Iran were going to take a chance, they could end the war very quickly if you just look at it in cold-blooded military terms. I mean, Saudi Arabia is one of the most fragile targets in the world. There's no water table. I mean, people would actually die of thirst. If you borrow, say, some of the newer Iranian missiles and you bomb the oil refineries on the Persian Gulf coast of Saudi Arabia, you bombed the desalinization plants, the country would be on its knees. Yeah. But then, you know, there's no tradition. There's no tradition of Iranian involvement in Yemen.
None
Iran whatsoever. In Syria, yes. Iran in Lebanon, yes. Iran in Iraq, that's a really complicated deal. But Yemen, no. It's just not there.
You got it. And again, even if you want to look at the doctrinal level, at the legal level, Zaydis are much more Shafi in terms of how they interpret the law. And again, it's just nonsense. And for me, it's rather sad that those people who have started to who have positioned their careers to become experts on Yemen kind of just completely exploit this and just play this line altogether. And it really does. It's so important for us to invest a little bit in trying to take words out of our audience's mouths because we just end up regurgitating New York Times phrases. Mm, yeah. So it's, you know, Iranian backed or it's the Houthis you know, it's a war between Saudi Arabia and Iran or proxy wars. Mm. And these are things that are just inaccuracies. They're decontextualizing this war. And that was the whole point of my book is to say to show that Yemen has been in the crosshairs of global capitalism and an empire building and resisting amazingly throughout the 20th century.
And we've kept you for an hour and we should let you tell people the name of your book again so they go out there and buy it because you've done an amazing interview and thanks very much for it. And now let's hear about your book again.
Oh, it's just a book entitled Destroying Yemen, What Chaos in Arabia Tells Us About the World. And really, the war in Yemen tells us so much about how the world functions. If we just spend a little bit of time of looking what happened, especially when Yemen unified, or just right before unification in 1990, it involves oil and involves finance, and it's kind of the evolution of the global economy towards increasingly speculative finance, the development industries, the whole importance of capturing infrastructure assets. I mean, there are all kinds of things that happen in chapters 5 and 6 that can be read in isolation. But what we need to understand is that Yemen, until today, has remained independent of all this. And they've remained resilient to the extent that they've actually kept at bay until now global empire. And
both the Ottomans, sorry, I have to draw, both the Ottomans and mostly the British. But I remember there was a great quote by an Ottoman general who said in this really elegant way, Yemen has proved the best foundry in the world. We send our armies there and they melt.
Right. And many of whom, by the way, ended up staying along and stayed with the imam. The imamate of North Yemen, which more or less was operating independent since 1911 when they signed a peace treaty with the Ottomans, and then survived the transition from the end of the empire to temporary occupation of the same Hudaydah coastline that we were talking about a little bit earlier. And they basically survived, and they were the, and it's something that I just only recently started to phrase in this way. They were the only independent Muslim polity in the world in the interwar period. Everyone else was under occupation, or you know, were basically puppets of global imperialists. And so this has long been a frustration. The one who started Aramco up in Saudi Arabia was sticking his nose for the first time in Yemen. He knew there was tons of oil there. And the imam basically said, get the hell out of here. We know we don't trust you. And so basically his only option was then to go to north. And he eventually became the founder of Aramco. So there's this kind of rather amazing connection of the entire, the stories of what happened in the Cold War period. No one understands that the imam, the so-called monarch.
We were just... beginning to look at the 1960s North Yemen civil war, and one of the most striking facts is that it's not sectarian in the way that everyone would expect now. It's not like North Yemen, the Shia versus South Yemen, the Sunni. I mean, the war looks in military terms very similar in some ways. You know, an overpowering air force that can't get the job done, but this is the Saudis backing what we would now call a Shia monarch, right? In fact, a Shia theocrat. And the secularists of both persuasions or whatever backing a modernizing officer coup. It just doesn't shape up the way it's supposed to.
And it actually gets even more juicy and more confounding for our general language. But if you actually consider the fact that the first ones to support and protest the creation of the Zionist state were was the imamate, right? And he framing it in very interesting progressive terms. The first ones to support the Free Officers Movement in 1953 was the imam of North Yemen. The first ones to have signed some kind of agreement with the Soviet Union in the 1920s was the imamate of North Yemen. The first ones to start advocating the pan-Arab state, the creation of a pan-Arab state, and was in a military alliance with Nasser, with Iraq, with the Ba'athists in Syria, was the imamate of North. The first one to start providing weapons for the Marxists of South Yemen fighting the British colonial state there was the imamate of North Yemen.
Did you just discover all the? I mean, I know you've got pretty deep knowledge of the whole region, as we've talked about your book. Yeah. But did you just discover a lot of this stuff to your surprise when you worked on this book, or had it already come up in other books?
I got an inkling. I had an inkling, but it really comes out when you start looking at the American and British archives of this period. There's very interesting. Gaps in American reporting in the archives. There have been a lot of documents been taken out in the last some 10, 15 years. You can actually see which regime, so whether it be Bush or whether it be Clinton or the Obama administration, taking out files. They go back to the 50s. They're taking files out in the 1950s.
Wow.
And you really have to go through some hoops to get access to this stuff. I just didn't have time to do it because I thought the book was more important to publish than just, you know, they fight for the next 2 years to get access to this stuff. But pairing, I have all kinds of tricks how to find those same documents and other files. I'm not going to share that because then the archivist will shut it down. But basically, you begin to see that, keep a long story short, the Americans are being played. And they're basically, North Yemen has leverage. They have Maoist China. They have the Soviets. They have Yugoslavia. The Swedes are even there, who are very progressive in their 50s and early until 1961. And the imamates and Nasser were very, very much allied until 1961. And you just need to start thinking about what happens in Egypt in 1961, which frustrates. And basically, the imamate says, you've lost you're no longer progressive.
So this is something where you're way ahead of me. I may have been thinking of it in simplistic terms, but I tend to accept what Salal said. You know, like we're sick of this. It's too old fashioned.
Yeah,
he said something like, "I'm going by Ginny Hill's book, Yemen Endures," where she quotes him as saying, "Look, I went to Baghdad, and Baghdad seemed like a paradise. If Baghdad seemed like a paradise, what do you think it's like here?" So, you know, he had some good sound bites at any rate. But it sounds like you're saying it's not that simple.
It definitely is not that simple. There were a lot more Yemenis who were traveling around. The imam was very nervous about the neighborhood. I mean, considering he had these nasty types running the show in the south, right, who was constantly trying to and had been occupying large tracts, then the Saudis. And then what's so interesting about the relationship with Nasser is that we forget who is his chief military man, Anwar Sadat.
Right.
Anwar Sadat's was actually married to a Yemeni family. And the brother of his wife became one of the principals in supporting the so-called revolution of 62, and then became a big player in the kind of subsequent disaster of that 8 to 10 year war, which cost hundreds of thousands of lives. And again, they were not the Saudis and the British were not backing the imamate. They basically entered into this war to isolate that whole dynasty. You can see in the documents, they basically say, and they agree with the Americans, this dynasty will never be brought back to power. We want to make sure, however, that we can somehow control this Nasser types. But Nasser by 61, 62 had gotten in bed with the Americans. And this is something we have to think about. The Kennedy administration has a very interesting agenda with the Middle East.
What was that? Operation something or other with it? But then apparently under, LBJ, but that's not till 1963. Yeah. Well, see, this is another huge topic that we're going to have to, if you're agreeable.
It's great. I mean, we should get you on
again.
If you're
agreeable, we should talk about this 1960s war, because I think your take is probably better than mine. And I've just been starting on this. Mm. So I'd like to know more. And we've already kept you too long.
Yeah.
But thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for the time, and hopefully we get to meet again soon.
Thank you, Issa.
Bye-bye.